Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. Today is Tuesday, and every Tuesday for some time here on the Inside Scoop, we've had Debate Tuesday, where I bring on air someone with whom I disagree, and we battle it out on the issues of the day. And I'll tell you why I do this. I think that since my role is sort of a government watchdog, to go there to criticize the powers that be, to challenge them all the time, it's important to have somebody to challenge me. And just like you do it all the time by calling in at 877-57-SCOOP, I think it's important to bring in someone from a party who I'm not a big supporter of, the Republican Party, to come in to challenge me on the air. You know, the right-wing talk show hosts, they don't do this. Rush Limbaugh, you try to call in, you disagree with him, he'll get you off the air as soon as possible. And then there are those like Bill O'Reilly on the Fox Propaganda Channel that claim to be moderates but aren't. I give you my opinions, I tell you what's going on in the government, and I invite those who disagree with me to come on and challenge me, because that's what democracy is all about. And frankly, I wish that our president would allow himself to be challenged more, and not just in these very occasional press conferences that he has, although he did have one just yesterday. The press conference was during the day. I think Bush likes it that way. It doesn't get a lot of viewing, and people understand that now that he's been elected. Well, I guess he doesn't have to worry too much about challenge. What's interesting to me, though, is polls already show that George Bush has the lowest approval rating of any president who's been reelected in American history. It has already dipped below 50 again. It's at 49%. I'm going to ask our guest today to explain some of those numbers, as well as to talk about, hey, you know, what Bush was talking about. Bush talked a lot about Social Security. I'm not sure where the $2 trillion is coming from to wipe out the Social Security system. I'm not sure Bush knows, but I'm going to see if our guest knows. Also, George Bush defended Don Rumsfeld. Big fan of Don Rumsfeld, even though a number of Republicans in Congress are not right now. And my guest, my special guest today, is not only a state chair of a college Republican group, but he's the state chair of Ohio. And so I'm going to ask him some questions about the election in Ohio and about the recount efforts there. His name is Ian Ellis. As I said, he is the state chair of the Ohio College Republicans. And I talked to him before the program, and I said to him what I say to all my guests, which is, you know, don't be a shill. Don't just go out there and defend the Republican Party, whether it's right or wrong. I don't do that with the Democrats. When I see something I think the Democrats are doing wrong, I let you know. And I would hope and I truly expect Ian Ellis to do the same, to disagree with his party where he thinks they're wrong. Again, that's what democracy is all about. But he's going to come on air in just a few seconds, and he's going to answer to me, and he's going to answer to you. All you have to do is dial toll-free 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can comment on the blog, as so many of you like to do, by going to www.radioinsidescoop.com. So, Ian, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Well, let me start with the press conference yesterday. Did you see most of that conference?
I did.
Okay. Well, there were a number of issues there. There's Social Security. Let's just sort of take them step by step. One of the things that a lot of people have criticized recently is Don Rumsfeld. And it's not just Democrats. You have John McCain saying he has no confidence in our defense secretary. You heard Hagel said the same. These are, you know, conservative Republicans. And a lot of criticism for the fact that Don Rumsfeld just didn't have the time to sign those condolence letters to the family members of people who've died, service members who've died in Iraq. And, you know, maybe Don Rumsfeld just doesn't have the time to sign those letters, and that's why he used the auto pen. He's got more important things to do. Is that your view, or is it your view that he should have signed those letters?
Well, if you saw today, he had an editorial that he released in the USA Today, and he explained his commitment to the troops. And I have no doubt that just as the president said yesterday, that Don Rumsfeld does have a sincere care for the men and women who are in harm's way. Certainly his job is a difficult one. I don't think anyone could disagree with that. And I think today, as he clarified, we're facing a distinct and unique challenge in Iraq that we haven't had to face in conventional wars.
Okay,
insurgency.
But the question I had was a pretty specific question. I mean, do you think Don Rumsfeld should take the time to sign those letters to Iraq, or do you think that he's got more important things to do?
I, I would say certainly he should be signing those letters, and I think that he signed many of them. The fact that he hasn't signed some of them, I think that's kind of quibbling over a pretty small issue.
Well, my impression is he's been using the auto pen, and look,
most politicians do.
They do.
If you go up on the Hill, and
there's no question about
things.
It. I've worked on the Hill. There's no question about it. For ordinary letters to constituents, I don't know. There are very few. There are very few politicians that sign every letter they write. But
yep.
When it comes to a condolence letter,
no, certainly, no. I mean, the ultimate sacrifice that they have given, and to my understanding, and what I have read, he signed many of these. But there have been some certainly that he has not. And I
okay.
think that.
And you also agree with me to criticize Don Rumsfeld on this point?
Yes, I mean,
all right, fair enough.
He certainly
good.
Should.
Okay. Let me say, the president says that, of course, he looked in Don Rumsfeld's heart, and that's how he knows he's a good man.
Certainly.
And, I don't know how – I mean, we all try to know our people well whom we work with. I don't know, that George Bush has any great insight into Don Rumsfeld's heart, any
okay.
more than anyone else. But Rumsfeld has been criticized for a lot of things. One of the things he's been criticized for, just most recently, by the troops themselves – is not providing enough body armor for
yep.
the troops. About the Secretary of Defense. He is working to transform our military so it functions better, it's lighter, it's ready to strike on a moment's notice. In other words, that the force structure meets the demands we face in the 21st century. And what's interesting to me is that it's lighter. And then he sort of interrupted himself and started over. By saying that our forces are lighter, that was definitely a Rumsfeld plan to make our forces lighter mm-hmm. because he felt we didn't need the conventional forces we need anymore. And that's one of the reasons why we don't have body armor for our troops or armor-plated vehicles for our tanks. So it's just interesting to me that the president's still trying to praise the value of a lighter military at the same time as, well, we don't have the armor we need. I don't know. What's your view on this?
Well, my view is that, as it says in this editorial here, he talks about the difference in the war where we haven't had to deal with insurgents. And in the war of the 21st century, we're fighting something which is drastically different. And the theory that we should have a lighter military so we can handle these new threats, I think certainly, has proven to be important. Certainly at the same time, we understand that in the budget process and the way that this money is allocated, that it's not the quickest and fastest process. And certainly they've continued, as they've had need, to put the body army over there, and especially for the Humvees and other things. And it's a slow process, and I think that throughout the 90s, the depletion of the military is one of the primary reasons why some of the hardware of the army has been depleted, and then now that we're transitioning into this lighter army theory, and I think that it's good because it is one of the ways that we can truly meet the new transforming.
And of course, this war in Iraq was, again, you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, but it did not. Saddam Hussein did not pose an imminent danger until we had the proper forces to do the job.
But
let me just make my point. Then you can let me make my point. Then you can disagree with me if you want. Colin Powell. When he went into the Persian Gulf War back in 1991, believed that we had to use overwhelming force. We needed hundreds of thousands of troops, far more than we've had in the recent conflict, even though all we were doing at that time was expelling the Iraqi army from Kuwait, not trying to occupy the entire country. And my traitors, we didn't need 700,000, 400,000, even 300,000 men and women. Just 100,000 would do the trick. In hindsight, don't you think that was, a miscalculation?
Well, I think if you can tell the speed at which we were in phases in the war, and I think that if you look facing, the Ba'athist separatists or even terrorists from other countries, and these people are continuing to fight a war, which, some people, liberals especially, I'm sure that you'll say that, when the mission we captured Saddam, toppled the government, but now we're fighting a completely different kind of war over there because we're fighting insurgents.
And you're saying that that Don Rumsfeld should have believed Paul Wolfowitz when he said they'd greet us as liberators, and he never should have expected that we'd be attacked by terrorists, and so he didn't make a mistake? That's not your point, is it?
Not necessarily. I mean, certainly you can argue about the degree to which we should have sent more troops. And I think that there are many well-respected Republicans who have said we should send more troops. And I would say that, you know, there have been times that I would agree.
Okay. Well, it's nice.
Of course, you know, it's difficult to say that any battle plan was perfect.
I'm just saying the judgment call
that was made and the way in which they approached this, I believe, was completely – well, of course, in hindsight, we can say these
things. And actually the generals that did say we should do it differently, as we all recall, were let go by the administration. Exactly.
Yep.
Let me go to the phones. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP. You can take Ian on. But let me get to my callers.
Great.
Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Ian Ellis.
This is your big fan from California, Mark, but I'm not allowed to listen to you on the Internet today, but I thought I'd call in anyway. And Ian,
yes,
does it concern you that most of the world now looks upon us and holds us in very low regard because, as they see it and as I see it, we invaded a country that really did nothing to provoke us? You use semantics like insurgents, and I see people in Iraq.
Let me just add before you answer that
question,
consider us to be occupiers rather than liberators. So are we fighting for the Iraqi people, or are we fighting against them?
I mean, certainly we're fighting for the Iraqi people. You know, the fact that we're dealing with these things, the different theories of institutionalism and how we can go into a country and work on these things, I think that certainly there's going to be a degree to which, you know, there's going to be some time there where it's going to take, you know, some of these institutions of democracy to develop and really develop a political culture. And I don't think that's disagreed
upon. But basically, it's just a hope,
question,
right? I mean, it's just we're just going to hope that we stay long enough and there will be democracy and it will flourish like the spring.
No, I don't think it's a hope. I think that, you know, with elections being held, you know, in January, I think certainly they will go forward. And the degree to which they're successful is still up in the air. But I think that, you know, I agree with the president. I believe that, you know, the Iraqi people, if given a free choice, aren't going to choose tyranny.
Well, but maybe they don't see it that way. Maybe they don't see the United States as we're the good guys that are fighting for a Shiite theocracy or a Sunni theocracy, our tyranny. I mean, don't you think the president is making a bit of a false choice here? If you're with us, you're with democracy. If solely out of the goodness of our own heart, my question, of course, is
why? Solely out of the goodness of our heart. I think that we sincerely have interests of, you know, security and these kind of things. I mean, no doubt terrorism is our primary threat to our security, and, you know, based upon the intelligence we had. I mean, the gentleman who called to answer his question, I mean, you know, that is the reason that we're there. And I think to the degree you want to call it occupation or these kind of things, I think is all the process. You know, I think that's the issue of semantic that you said. And also to answer his question more directly, I'd like to have him define who most of the world is.
Well, he's still here. Dave, did Ian answer your question?
No, he hasn't.
Okay. No,
Are you one of those Republicans that wants to make us believe that Iraq had something to do with the events of 9/11? Are you one of those people?
No, I am not.
Okay.
Okay, but
by
you said that it was
most of the world, I'd say mostly I'm talking about Europe and an awful lot of Asia, as I understand it right now, Egypt, India, most of Africa.
Don't forget Canada, too. our friendliest nation in all of our history, even they. Don't you think, Ian, when even Canada, a country that never says peep the United States and is our largest trading partner, has always had terrific relations with us, when Canada says, whoa, United States, what are you doing here? Don't you think we need to open our eyes and take note of what the rest of the world is thinking?
Well, certainly, but I, you know, the president's right to say that we'll never allow another country to have veto power over our national security.
Okay, but here's the question. How does Iraq involve our national security? I mean, any more than, say, for example, North Korea and Iran, they're developing nuclear weapons right now.
Certainly. And there are approaches that are in place to address those issues. I mean, do you disagree with the way that we're handling Iran and North Korea?
Well, I do. I mean, it seems to me that if we're doing regime change in Iraq to stop a dictator from getting weapons of mass destruction, and that's what the president told us. Now, maybe he was lying to us.
Is that what you believe, though?
Do you want
regime change in both Iran and North Korea?
I'd love to see a regime change in Iran and North Korea, but that doesn't necessarily mean we invade tomorrow. There are other ways to get regime change.
Well, that's the president's position.
But what I'd like to hear you explain is how a president who took America to war, saying we have to go to war in Iraq to get regime change because Saddam Hussein is going to get these weapons of mass destruction, particularly nuclear weapons. He made that argument.
He did.
Now that we know that Saddam Hussein wasn't getting those weapons, wasn't even, you know, at best this was sort of an idea in his head. He had taken no steps toward it. And yet we know that in North Korea, a vicious dictator has killed millions of his own people. In Iran, they've killed thousands of their own people. They are developing nuclear weapons. They are arming terrorists, what Iran is doing with Hezbollah. How can you justify us choosing this threat of a sixth or seventh order when we got threats of the first and second order facing us?
I don't think that it's the seventh order. I think that, I mean, look at, you know, you have the...
Well, let's see, John North Kerry Korea... Well, let me see if I can name
based
six.
Upon the, you know, they voted for the war based upon the intelligence they had in front of them, and that's an old debate.
Well, that's not true. That's not true. It's not true that
they voted for the war based upon the intelligence they were given.
It is an old debate, but just to be clear, the members of Congress did not have the same intelligence the president had. The president and the vice president manipulated the intelligence. We just saw a CIA agent just 2 days ago come out and say that he was ordered to falsify information about weapons of mass destruction that was presented to the Congress. So he was giving false information to Congress, and his bosses, who ordered him to do it, have not been fired, have not been looked into.
Where's this news? I mean, I've been watching the news relatively closely, and I haven't seen this come out.
I will send you the article.
I would love to see it.
I will send you the article. Dave, anything more? We got to move on.
Well, I'd have 100 questions, but Ian, the one main one. Could you tell us anything that you feel this administration has done to benefit the normal average citizen of the United States? Could you name anything at all? Tax breaks for the very rich didn't benefit most of them.
Certainly. I think that the president particularly, and, you know, if you look at job growth, 7 out of 10 jobs in America are produced by small businesses. And if you look at the president's business plan, and particularly the way that he has reformed some of the business code, particularly the tax cuts, were directed towards small business owners. You can argue that those people are in the top 2%. Yeah, a lot of them are in the top 10%. But they're also the people who are doing the hiring. And for normal average Americans, having a job is an important thing. And I think the president's economic policies of cutting taxes for the people who are creating jobs is a policy which really, at the end of the day, helps to create the ownership society that he's talking about, and also helps to, you know, really impact people's lives in a tangible way.
Dave, thank you very much for your call.
Reality,
I appreciate it.
The reality, of course, is the job market's gone to hell, and I think you know that.
Well, I think that our economy's grown in the last, you know, year and a half in a clip that hasn't seen these...
Well, and also I would respond, first of all, we know that George Bush, there's less jobs still today than there was when he came into power. But there's something I think broader here.
Certainly.
And it's a question of economics. And it's something that I learned in my economics class, and I have a degree, magna cum laude in economics. And that is that you don't create jobs by giving more money to employers, because it doesn't really make sense. You're an employer, okay, and you have a business, and someone gives you $100,000. And let's say demand for your product is the same.
Yep.
Are you going to hire more employees? No. You'll take the money and you'll pocket it and you'll say thank you very much. Now take the same $100,000 and give it, instead of giving it to the one business owner, give $1,000 to 100 people. Now that would spark demand. That would get more people to buy products. That would actually encourage the price. It would make the prices go up, and it would make the factories, you know, churn. And then the employers got to hire more people to deal with the demand. Doesn't it make more sense to give tax cuts to the poor and middle class, who are the consumers, rather than the rich, who is, as I see it, won't provide jobs just because you give them money?
Well, I'm not a magna cum laude in economics, but if you look at the difference in, I mean, consumption spending, which is the tax cut you just described, would increase consumption spending, and it's short term.
How does giving a tax cut that's majority weighted to the top 1%?
I'm just going to explain that. I mean, if you give like what you just said, a tax cut to lower and middle, first of all, lower class don't really pay very many taxes. That's pretty statistically proven. But that kind of tax cut increases consumption spending, which is only short term growth. But, you know, I'm here in Ohio, and, you know, we're one of the hardest states that's been hit by these job numbers. I mean, certainly, you know, we here know better than most. And, you know, I had the chance to sit down and when Secretary Don Evans came to Ohio, I had a chance to listen in on a conversation that he had with at a round table with a number of small business owners, talking about the hundreds of thousands of dollars that these men had been given, because the tax cuts aren't just money that they can take. It's actually incentives for specific business investments that they can make. So if they are tax-free on certain kinds of investments for capital formation for their business, which only they can use to increase their payroll.
As far as
so
I'm concerned,
they're getting an income tax.
Well, we know, for example, they are. I mean, if you look at the estate tax, you look at the income tax, there are simply benefits that are just going to the very wealthy. Look at dividends, where you don't do work at all, and those things are cut. I got another caller on the line, though.
Great.
Let me go to the caller, and then we're going to take a quick commercial break. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Ian Ellis.
Hey, guys. How are you? Just wanted to make a comment on what Ian said. Ian said that Bush flew over there to say mission was accomplished. Actually, he was off the coast of California on an aircraft carrier, and if they would have positioned the camera a little bit differently, you could have seen our beautiful mountains in the background.
Fair point. In fact, I believe they turned the carrier around so that you couldn't see the California mountains in the background.
Probably. Also, I don't think you're fighting for the people when you've killed over 100,000 of their innocent people, and you're also treating United States citizens like they're insurgents by lying to them through the Pentagon and through CNN. So that argument I don't think really works. And also, Richard Clark, during the 9/11 Commission, blatantly said that the information that the president had on the intelligence in Iraq was cooked information.
Caller, you make some tough points. We have to go to commercial break. I'm going to give Ian the whole commercial to think about how to answer your tough questions. It'll be just like a Jeopardy program, all right? So when we come back, we're going to give Ian a chance to answer our caller's very tough questions.
Wonderful.
Right after these messages.
Consultant who will explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
This is a financial update. Average mortgage rates took a slight dip this week.
Sorry to interrupt, but LendingTree.com is the only place where banks compete over your mortgage. Then you get up to 4 real offers to choose from within minutes. So do better and choose from low rates. Call LendingTree now at 1-800-555-TREE. That's 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win.
I know everything. Languages? Yes. Boiling points? Celsius and Fahrenheit? Yes. World capitals? Please. So, not too long ago, I tried to get a refi, and it got turned down. And this is the best part. The loan officer says to me, sir, do you know what your credit score is? So, I looked at her and said, tell me, do you know what the population of Liechtenstein is? Huh? Do you? She didn't.
Get in the know. Check out ScorePower from Equifax. You'll get your credit report, credit score, and you'll learn how your credit decisions can affect your score, all for only $14.95. And knowing that is how you get the credit you deserve. So check out ScorePower at Equifax.com or call 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Well, now I have my credit score up to 760, the same number of days it took Frenchman Michel Lapointe to circle the globe on a bike. Yeah, I'll bet you didn't know that.
Get the power. Score power.
I'm just a cowboy who's got achy knees, and the joint pain they call osteoarthritis. I tried over-the-counter pills, they weren't right for me. So I tried some prescriptions, and they made me foggy. And that's when I found you, Celebrex, for joint pain relief, no more, no less. Yeehaw!
Celebrex targets the source of pain and inflammation. It's non-narcotic. It doesn't make you foggy or slow you down. Ask your doctor about Celebrex celecoxib capsules. Celebrex should not be taken if you've had aspirin-sensitive asthma or allergic reaction due to aspirin or other arthritis medicines or certain drugs called sulfonamides. In rare cases, serious stomach problems such as bleeding can occur without warning. Tell your doctor if you have kidney or liver problems. To learn more, call 1-888-CELEBREX, visit Celebrex.com, or see our ad in Real Simple. Just one prescription Celebrex gives 24-hour relief.
Ask your doctor about Celebrex. Joint pain relief, no more, no less.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to the image. So I'm going to just attack my own commercial there, but I think that's there because it's an old one, and I wanted to warn our listeners about that if you haven't heard that. But we're going back to Debate Tuesday. My guest is Ian Ellis. He's the state chair of the Ohio College Republicans. And before we ask some tough questions by our
George Bush wasn't even anywhere close to Iraq when he declared mission accomplished, which was a complete and total lie. Obviously.
Okay, all right. Those are tough questions. I want to take them one at a time so that Ian can get them. Let's start with Richard Clark, who's basically has testified supporting what I've said, which is that we cooked the intelligence to say there was weapons of mass destruction in Iraq when there was no evidence really that there was. Ian?
Yes. Well, Richard Clark, I think we all know the distance that has been put between him and the administration based upon that opinion that he has. I think that those that...
Yeah, they don't like his opinion.
They don't like his opinion because they know and they believe that it's false. Because the British intelligence that we were given and the other forms of intelligence that we gathered, Richard Clark believed that it was cooked, but the administration and the decision that they made was based upon intelligence they received from a number of sources. So I think that, you know, certainly Richard Clark's entitled to his opinion. But,
well, Richard Clark obviously is more than an opinion guy. He was the terrorism czar, and basically he was stating exactly what Colin Powell said in a February 2001 speech in Cairo, Egypt, that never gets enough attention, when he says Iraq basically is fairly weak now, is not pursuing weapons of mass destruction, is about the third of the power that it was during the Gulf War, and is not something we need to worry about. Obviously, they had to make something up, and so they had to get those books. I mean, the administration is not going to admit, yes, we cooked the books, but it sounds to me like you're just sort of buying their argument.
Please also remember Hans Blix, the UN weapons inspector, also said that they would not find weapons, and I guess we didn't want to believe his faulty intelligence either.
They're tough questions, Ian.
No doubt, but to me, it sounds like a he said, she said argument. I mean, you're going to talk about this guy here and, you know, the intelligence that was given them based upon these things, just as I said. I mean, if you want to cite these, to me, it sounds more like conspiracy theory than anything else.
Well, you know, when the vice president is going down to the CIA, which I don't know if any other vice president's done this, he goes down to Langley, he sits there with the analysts, he starts rifling through their papers, new national security advisor, and he himself leaks memos to the Weekly Standard that later the administration has to distance himself from because they're false intelligence. You got the president of the United States giving a State of the Union speech claiming that there's nuclear, you know, stop trying to get nuclear stuff in Niger that turns out to be false, and you got poor Colin Powell, and I don't think Colin Powell believed it. I mean, I think he believed it when he said it.
They weren't even photos. They were drawings, Mark.
Now, that I hadn't heard.
They were drawings.
That I hadn't heard. Let me go to some of your other questions, though, because they were good and tough questions.
But,
you're aware, Ian, that the ship, the mission accomplished ship, was just a few miles from the coast of California, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, what about Iraqi civilians? Now, some estimates we've seen have said that up to 100,000 are dead. I don't have to necessarily believe those. The lower estimates I've seen have said that 20,000.
Poor civilians were killed. I mean, no doubt that was in the original war and continued. Certainly, I would... From the testimonies that have been released, we see how the Defense Department and, you know, the military certainly targeted their attacks as best they could. But I think to say that we would have a war without casualties, I mean, what would you suggest would be an acceptable number? I mean, would you want none? I mean, would
my
you
view
want
is
100?
That
Saddam, I mean, we are in a war.
Well, I understand, but my view is it was a war of choice. I mean, in Afghanistan, I think it's more justified.
So
we were attacked.
If you believe it's a war of choice, I mean, then you're arguing, well, the war cost too much, but, you know, we should have gone there in the first place.
That's obviously what I'm arguing. That's exactly.
I mean, then you're arguing, well, the war cost too much, but, you know, we should have gone there in the first place.
That's obviously what I'm arguing. That's exactly what I'm arguing. Hey, caller, you had one more point, and you raised four. What was the last one?
Remind me.
Some of the bloggers are putting me on the spot. So you got some conservatives that are backing you up, and I'm going to read some of those blog entries.
First.
Call in to the conservative blog. I'm not sure about that, but anyway.
I don't know either.
This one writes, Mark, Saddam is a terrorist. He gave cash rewards to anyone who would go into Israel and terrorists that went into Israel. He is one of 20 Arab nations, in fact, that give money to terrorists that attack Israel. The big sponsor of Hezbollah right now is Iran, and the biggest sponsor Iraq ever did. That, of course, does not justify what Iraq did, but my point is there was a lot worse out there. I don't know if you want to make a comment on that, or should I go on to the next blog comment?
No, I mean, I would say certainly there are many threats, and we have to make choices about which threats that we will go after. And I think based upon the intelligence of the future, I mean, after these elections and after the Iraqis have a constitution, they really will be an example to the countries around them. I mean, look at Syria and Iran, both sharing large borders with Iraq. And if they're forced to, you know, their citizens are seeing the, you know, Iraqis who are free and understand these things, I think that it's going to begin to put pressure on the nations that are around them.
But Ian, explain this to me. You say we made the right choice. You know, mm-hmm. if I've got five people out there that want to attack me, okay, and one guy is sort of sitting there playing with rocks that he can throw at me, and two of them are pointing guns at me, and two others are developing a nuclear warhead to drop on me. If I attack the guy playing with rocks to make an example of him to the others,
based upon the intelligence that we had, that's not the scenario that was drawn. And we know that North Korea is not a direct threat to the United States.
It can
those kind of things. As we approach North Korea as a threat to regional stability, it's very imminent. But the way in which we're handling it, through the seven nation talks or nine, I believe,
Ian,
certainly encouraging China. But
it's not just regional stability. North Korea has a long range missile. That can hit Los Angeles. Yes, it can hit Los Angeles. It can hit the West Coast. It's far longer than anything that Iraq ever had. And now, will he use it or not? I don't know. But it seems to me that it's a much greater threat. And he's got nuclear weapons. He developed nuclear weapons while George Bush was president. Now, why do we go to war in Iraq because of weapons of mass destruction when we have two
countries?
Because
there are different ways that you handle different situations.
Okay, so
I mean, many well-respected statesmen, understand that just because we go into one country one way doesn't mean that we have to apply that theory to everything.
Okay, why couldn't
that's foolish international policy.
Why couldn't we have used a containment strategy with Saddam Hussein? Why couldn't we have negotiated with him the way we're doing right now with North Korea and Iran, with far loss of American money, American lives? And I mean, he was pretty cornered. His army was far weaker than it was in the Gulf War. It seems to me that what we did is this. We attacked him because he was easy. It kind of reminds me of the old story of the drunk who loses his glasses, and he's looking underneath the lamppost. And the guy comes up to the drunk, and he says, what's wrong? He says, I lost my glasses. He said, oh, you lost them over here? He said, no, I lost them about a half mile down the road. And he said, well, why are you looking under here? And he said, well, the light's better. I mean, didn't we attack Iraq because George Bush was embarrassed that he didn't get al-Qaeda, the real mass murderer who killed 3,000 Americans, Osama bin Laden? He failed to get him at Tora Bora. He messed that up. So he said, you know what? I'm going to attack this low-level threat and make me look good before the American people.
Is that what you believe?
That is what I believe. Yes, it is. I mean, there's also oil revenue, obviously, in January of
2001. Throw a little bit of that one in there with the oil war. No, I mean, to go back to your original thing about, I mean, we know what the policy of containment has produced throughout at least the last century. We have two wars in which containment, the policy of détente, both have proved to be pretty miserable policies.
Actually, I think we won the Cold War through containment, didn't we? I don't remember us invading Moscow.
No, we certainly didn't, but that was due to great due to great diplomacy.
Great. Let's do it again. I mean,
diplomacy obviously failed. I mean, look, you had a decade of UN resolutions that didn't seem to cut it.
I read Saddam Hussein was willing to step down from power and set up a democracy. Whether he would have done it, I don't know.
Did you read that?
Yes, in the New York Times. He made overtures to America.
You think Saddam was going to step down from power?
I think he made the offer. And so I think what we had to do
to
was
whom?
He made it to American negotiators. To American negotiators.
Okay.
And so what we should have done, I believe, is called his bluff. Do I think he would have accepted it? I'm not so sure. But I would have called his bluff and put it in, then get that in a UN resolution. And then when he doesn't comply, then we have a lot more incentive, not just for the Iraqi people to understand what we're fighting for. Listen, we've got to go to another commercial. Do you have a quick response?
I was just saying, I don't really recommend playing poker with the national security interests of our nation, but that's fine.
I'm afraid that's what we're doing right now in Korea and Iran. We got to go to commercial break. When we come back, I got another conservative blogger who challenges me about taxes. I want to get back and ask you that question. How are we paying for Social Security?
Yeah,
and then I got to end on Ohio election.
There we go.
Right after this.
What is it about ultra-right conservatives who bill careers as tongue-clucking scolds? They constantly preach about the moral failings of the rest of us, yet they keep getting caught with their own pants down, morally speaking. I don't merely mean the Falwells, Swaggerts, and other publicly compromised televangelists, but also the right-wing politicos who prance about so piously on their moral high horses. For example, how swell to be lectured on family values by Newt Gingrich, who is now on his third marriage, or is it number four? Also, how perfect to have Bill Bennett anoint himself as the nation's arbiter of conservative virtues, while he sneaks around feeding his gambling addiction. And who can forget the bombastic moral authority of the airwaves, Rush Limbaugh, using his housekeeper to score about it? Are these people its own especially noisy tongue cluckers? The Right Honorable Boris Johnson. He's the Latin-spouting, Eton-schooled editor of the right-wing Spectator, a London newspaper long tied to England's plutocratic Conservative Party. Indeed, Boris himself is a Conservative Party member of the Parliament, where he has served as the party's official spokesperson on cultural policies, freely criticizing the personal morality of others. He's now been removed from that party post, however, since it has been revealed that Boris the Moralist, who is married and has four children, has been cheating on his wife, having an affair with a society columnist at his paper. Furthermore, Boris impregnated the mistress, she had an abortion, and he tried to lie about it, initially calling the accusations an inverted pyramid of piffle. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a great phrase! Right-wingers lecturing us on morality are dumping a pyramid of political piffle on us.
If you've been thinking about consolidating your federal student loans, it's time to call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
One in four adults has high blood pressure. If you're one of them and you have a cold, Coricidin HBP has surprising news for you. The American Heart Association recognizes that decongestants found in many leading cold medicines can raise your blood pressure and interfere with blood pressure medication. So why risk it? Only decongestant-free Coricidin HBP provides a line of safe formulated for people with high blood pressure.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine, and I've got here under the hot seat the state chair of the Ohio College Republicans. His name is Ian Ellis, and I'm very grateful for him to come here and take me on, take on some of my listeners, and try to present the cause of his party, which, after all, did appear to win the election. Americans are buying his argument. I don't know. Kerry won the debates. Hands down, all the Americans agreed. So how is it that Kerry wins all three debates and Bush becomes president? I'm not sure, but we're going to get to some of the election questions in a little bit. I want to get first to Social Security and also read a couple more blog comments. I got one, again, the conservatives seem to add to the blog. Nathan writes, Mark, how would you give money to the poor and middle class? They don't pay enough taxes to begin with. To give them a tax break, would you simply just give money so you reward someone for being poor? Nathan, taxes. Bush has been breaking open that black box that Al Gore tried to protect and take all that money, and he's been spending it on Iraq and so forth. And they do pay taxes, and we have you noticed that the one tax relief that hasn't been given by this administration is the Social Security tax, which is a regressive tax. It's a tax that taxes the poor more than the rich because there's a cap at some $80,000-some-odd. So, yes, I would give money back to the poor from the Social Security taxes. And, you know, in the idea that you suggested if someone doesn't earn income, we should give them money, that actually was Richard Nixon's idea back in the 70s. They called it a negative income tax. It does help demand for the working poor, not for people who aren't trying to earn a living. And, of course, Richard Nixon would be considered a left-wing liberal today by the right-wing conservatives in today's party. Let me ask you this, though, Ian, about Social Security. I listened very carefully to the president's press conference, and they asked him again and again and again, how are you going to pay for it? Are you going to raise Social Security taxes? Are you going to cut benefits for seniors? Are you going to just print money and hand it out, you know, and raise our inflation rates? And the president said, I'm not going to negotiate with myself. I'm not going to tell how I'm going to pay for it. That's my secret, and I'm sticking to it. How are we going to pay the $2 trillion that the president wants to end Social Security?
Well, I certainly can't claim to be a Social Security expert, although I will say that as you mentioned, the president's not going to negotiate with himself, and he's going to allow the lawmakers and those who do set the budget to make those decisions. Certainly, with a system such as Social Security that is, broken, I guess 2018 is when it'll be bankrupt, and more money going out than coming in, and that's the problem that we have, and it's not a perfect system, and the road to recovery isn't necessarily going to be an easy one. And I think that the president's leadership is to be commended, because they say this is, the issue of Social Security is one that a Republican really shouldn't touch. At least if he does, he's not going to live.
Well, I'm
and
not
the
sure.
The president's going out there, 12 years before this thing is going to break, and saying, "Hey, we need to do something about it."
Yeah,
and
but he's not
allowing Congress in a bipartisan way to address this issue, saying these are the guidelines. I'm not going to negotiate and do your job for you.
Yeah, I'm not going to tell you where the $2 trillion comes from. Go ahead, find $2 trillion out of nowhere, and go ahead and spend it. And I'm not going to say where I'm going to get it. No, I want you, Congress, to say where you're going to get it, and then I can complain about it. That doesn't seem to me to be leadership.
Well, you said it earlier. You said that you want Social Security being a regressive tax, which it is.
Yep.
You want those people, the poor class to have, the poorer to have. To have more money in their
right.
in their pockets. Well,
right.
the president's plan directly it does that in the sense that they're going to be able to set up a private account, and that's money that, as you said, the black box. He can't break it open if it's their own private account. Which,
well, he's already broken open the Social Security black box. I wouldn't put it past him to break open anything.
First of all, he won't be the one breaking. It'll be the next president. But
fair enough.
I'm just saying, though. I think that the system he's setting up and the laws that are going to be enacted, should he be successful, I think will do exactly what you said you just wanted. Is what poor people, poorer class, middle class, and even those who aren't going to exceed the 80,000 will be able to set up an individual account which won't be used to pay for others. If you look at a country like Peru, I believe is a classic example. Of a country that has a good Social Security system because they have set up these kind of individual responsibility, ultimately creating this, this ownership society, which is so important.
But Ian, I got news for you, and I don't think it's news. I think you know this. We already can do this. We have IRAs, which allow people to set aside their own money tax-free for their own retirement.
Yep.
We have 401ks that allow that. All that Social Security does, and this I found this very interesting what the president said, all that Social Security does is protect people from their own mistakes. What Bush wants to do is give up the Social Security trust fund for people to gamble with, and I'm not sure how he's going to do it.
The right word.
Well, if they invested in Enron and lose their shirts, and they're now 75 years old,
okay,
and they're 80 years old, and they're starving in the streets, do you think we should let them starve, or should we provide for them?
I don't believe that's exactly. Certainly that's one of the finer points that's going to have to be ironed out.
It happened in the 20s.
Controlling this money.
It happened in the 30s. It happened in the Great Depression. People make mistakes.
Yeah.
Why not? Why? Look, here's the deal.
It's not going to be that free market. They're not going to. They're not going to choose to put their whole Social Security account on. On your pharmaceutical company.
I've been in Las Vegas. I've seen somebody who couldn't afford it put thousands of dollars on Double Down.
Certainly.
People don't always make the smartest decisions.
No, they don't.
And I'll tell you something that I also saw in the president's talk about Social Security that's really struck me is that people should be able to pass it on to their children.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that really bothered me, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
It seems to me the purpose of Social Security is insurance. People think of it as a retirement plan. It's insurance.
Security.
It's insurance against living too long. If you have a certain nest egg and you live to the age of 72, you'll have enough to provide for yourself in retirement. But you might live to be 85, 90, 95, and we don't want Americans wishing they were dead because they don't have enough money to live on. The purpose of Social Security way back to the 1930s is that it's a gamble. It's an annuity. It's a life insurance policy. What it says is that if you die early, your funds are going to go to someone who lives longer. And that way we provide for everyone. And everyone knows that if you live to be 103, you will still be provided for. But the idea that we're going to let those that die at 72 pass it on to their children, there's just not going to be enough money left there for those that live long.
Being not an expert on Social Security, I can't say that I know exactly. I know that the actuarial tables, as you mentioned, are the important part of Social Security. That's what makes the system work. I can't speak to that.
The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP. We appreciate your calls. 877-57-SCOOP. Or you can respond on the blog, as so many of you already have, at www.radioinsidescoop.com. I got a comment here from Vicky. Now, I love Vicky. I think she's my favorite conservative listener.
There you go.
She's a fundamentalist Christian. I I respect her religious beliefs. And she argues that if we didn't, if we had much fewer abortions, as she said, stop killing over a million babies, we have enough to pay for Social Security. Vicky, with all due respect to your beliefs, you know, I don't think this is an abortion issue. I think it's a separate issue. We can have immigration to provide those. I really see it as a completely separate issue, but, you know, I do appreciate your writing. I do want to spend the last 10 minutes or so talking about Ohio election. Now, you were
great
there on the ground, and I got to congratulate you.
Well,
you did get out your people to vote.
We did.
And, you know, even though I am very sorry about the result, you must feel pretty good that Ohio was the swing state. After all, if Ohio goes to Kerry, your guy loses.
Yes.
So it was Ohio that made the difference. Let me ask you this. What do you think it was that made the difference in Ohio for you?
Well, I think, you know, if we look at turnout, I mean, the numbers were, you know, astronomical. Vote goals were exceeded by, you know, hundreds and thousands in some cases. And, you know, I think that ultimately it came down to grassroots effort, and I think that both sides realized that. I think certainly, you know, whether Democrat or liberal organizations, both were also very successful in turning out their voters. And I think at the end of the day, we just saw that when both parties and both organizations on either side turned out their voters in one of the largest grassroots movements that, you know, politics maybe has ever seen, that, you know, we won by 140,000 votes. And, you know, it's certainly a margin.
Actually, it's 120,000 under the latest count.
Okay.
But let me raise a more nefarious question.
Sure.
Because I have my concerns, and I know my listeners do as well.
Certainly.
The exit polls in Ohio showed Kerry ahead by 52.3 to 47.7. They showed Kerry ahead in Florida. They showed Kerry ahead in Virginia, of all states, by a close margin. They showed Kerry way ahead in Pennsylvania, turned out to be a much closer margin. Every single one of the exit polls in all the swing states predicted a larger Kerry victory. Now, there's only two possibilities here. I think you'll agree with me, only two possibilities. One is the exit polls got it wrong. And the other is that something was screwy with the voting systems. I mean, those are the only two possibilities, right?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, and everyone's been talking about the exit polls getting wrong, but these are exit polls in various states. There are no raw data. And let me talk to you a little about history, which I'm sure you're aware of following politics. Whenever we've had large turnout in the past 10 years, that has been a Democratic victory. You can go back to 92, large turnout, Democratic victory. 94, small turnout, Republican victory. 96, large turnout, Democratic victory. 98, large turnout, Democratic. 2000, large turnout, Democratic. 2002, small turnout, Republican victory.
Maybe
2004, we had
the
largest turnout we've had since the 60s.
Yep.
And suddenly we're supposed to believe that this time it helped the Republicans. Can you understand why some people are questioning, particularly when you got electronic machines that are adding up the ballots and they're not showing us the source code?
Mm-hmm.
They're questioning maybe there's some rigging going on.
Well, to be honest, there are a lot of variables involved with, you know, coming down to that issue. You know, you just touched on, you know, about 10. I mean, ultimately the grassroots structure. I read a piece in, I believe it was either Time or Newsweek, you know, talking about some of the liberal organizations, MoveOn.org and their grassroots effort out here, and talking about how they, you know, didn't really expect that, you know, generally speaking, grassroots normally is best organized within the city, and that's why large turnouts go Democrat. But this year, I mean, with a truly grassroots effort, the suburbs and even the rural areas were mobilized in a grassroots way that they never had before due to, you know, some relatively advanced technology.
But don't you think
that's a great example of why a super turnout such as we had leaned Republican?
But if Kerry had won the election, and he'd won Ohio and he'd won the election, you know, you'd hear the same thing. Well, the Democrats increased their turnout. I mean, what you're saying is based on a result that I got to tell you, a lot of people question. I mean, why is it – let me ask you, why is it that Kenneth Blackwell – and you told me you – Kenneth Blackwell is the Secretary of State of Ohio. He is a partisan Republican. He was, I think, co-chairman of the Bush campaign.
He was one of the co-chairs.
That's what I thought. Now, why did he believe it necessary to slow down the attempts to recount the Ohio vote? Why not to have a fair election? Let me just see if I can get some agreement from you on this. To have a fair election, all the source code for all election machinery should be published and made public and should be put in. As a software programmer that came on my show Sunday, Clinton Curtis said, you buy a new machine and you have everybody watch you, Republican, Democrat. You go in and you put the machine on so everyone can see what the source code is. You have paper receipts to protect against fraud, and you are willing to count the votes as soon as possible after the election. Count, in fact, there's some 92,000 votes in Ohio, I understand, that were never counted because of the punch card system. Shouldn't Republicans and Democrats, no matter what their partisan leanings, agree on the need for review of source codes, paper receipts for ballots, and a quick recount if necessary?
Well, I think that fundamentally, I mean, if you look at the system, the 88 counties in the Board of Elections here in Ohio, you know, are comprised of both Republicans and Democrats, same throughout the whole country. And these Republicans and Democrat Board of Elections at the county level certify their election returns just at the beginning of this month. You know, I can't speak on behalf of Secretary of State and that office, but you know, these are bipartisan official governmental agencies that take care of these things. Whether it's led by a Republican or a Democrat, at the county level where these votes are counted, they are done by people who are both Republican and Democrat. So unless you're willing to say that these Democrats are in cahoots with the Republicans, I don't believe there's much of a conspiracy.
Here's the problem, and this is something that, again, Clinton Curtis talked about on my show last Sunday. Let me recommend that for anyone who wants to check out the archive. It was a stunning show. Clinton Curtis is a lifelong Republican, or at least was. I don't think he is anymore. Was a lifelong Republican, software developer for Yang Enterprises, which was connected with today Congressman Tom Feeney. And what he said is that because the lower-level county computers talk with the overall tabulator, that can go both ways. And the tabulator can speak back to them and tell them, as he designed software that Curtis claims Tom Feeney asked him to design, if your candidate's ahead, it stays the same. If your candidate's behind, it increases all the votes in every county to make it a total of 51-49. What it does is if Bush is ahead 70-30, it bumps it up one to 71-29. If Kerry's ahead 80-20 in Cleveland, it would bump him down 79-21. And so let me just see if I can get an agreement from you that we need to explore this source code and that you will support the Republican Party opening up the source code of all election machines to protect American democracy in the future. I mean, that's fair, isn't it?
Well, I think certainly as we move forward with the Help America Vote Act, these things will be, you know, evaluated. I think the Secretary of State certainly didn't make a decision based upon, relenting, and restricting democracy in any way.
Well, you know, you
but
can
we
say
understand that.
That
in the 3 years that Help America Vote Act was out there, there are only so many changes that you can make.
Well, I tell you this. Rush Holt, Congressman of New Jersey, has had a bill since 01, or at least since 02. It's been a long time out there, that says we need to have paper receipts so that there is a paper record of every vote cast. And his bill, which is supported, as I understand, by a majority of both houses of Congress, was not allowed to come to a vote by the Republican leadership. I want to know if you agree with me that that they were wrong.
No, I think a paper receipt is something in the future. I think the reason it was made is because it wasn't a technology that could be implemented. There are multiple companies. There aren't just one. There
it was
are not
implemented
just one
in
software
Nevada.
Hardware company out there doing this. There are many companies. It takes a lot of work to put these kind of things into effect. And the Republican Party was, you know, being conservative about how they approach this because they knew that if you just throw a new system into an election, you know, within a year, then it's difficult and there are going to be bugs. And because of the sensitivity of this election, it was important that we do it well.
And I wish
wasn't going to happen.
Ian, I wish you were right, but they did throw new systems right in the middle. They did that in Florida, for example, where they put in new electronic systems without a paper ballot. And I do want to praise one state, it's the state of Nevada, even though it went for George Bush. They put in electronic ballot machines with paper records. So let no one say that it couldn't be done. Nevada did it. We only got a couple minutes left. I do have one caller who's hanging on. Caller, real quick, ask your question, please.
This is Ed from New York. Yeah. I'd like to ask your guest what he thinks of all of the people who died today in Iraq just before the holiday season and how Mr. Bush is going to go ahead and explain that to wish these people a happy holiday. Isn't it about time we get out of Iraq?
Okay, thank you for your question. When are we going to get out of Iraq? Ian, what do you think?
Well, I think that if we were to right now set an artificial date for when we get out of Iraq, I think that, you know, the terrorists would say, okay, day after that is the day we, you know, really kick things off. I mean, we all know that, you know,
Would you call them terrorists? Let me ask you this. And we don't have a lot of time, but if an elected government in January asked the U.S. troops to leave, should they leave?
That's the decision we have to make. You know, you can't really argue hypotheticals, I don't believe. I think that, you know, as we saw today, you know, even with the incident in Mosul, that, you know, things are like this are unpredictable. And I think to say January 1st, I think these are decisions that are made, you know, on a daily and weekly basis. And that's why, you know, I voted for the president and I support him, is because I believe that as a leader, he's strong and committed to doing these things. And I trust him to make the decisions because they're not always easy. And I think that it's something that we've seen, we've talked about today, these decisions aren't easy.
No, and in fact, they had a wonderful Saturday Night Live episode where they showed the president his debate saying, it's hard. It's hard work here.
I saw that.
I want to thank you for coming here.
Thank you very much.
Debate Tuesday goes very quickly. You've answered a lot of very tough questions from myself and my listeners.
Yes.
I want to thank you for coming on, and I'll invite you to come back again sometime. We got tomorrow a very interesting show. We've got a progressive think tank that's going to talk about, well, 2004. The year is about over. What went wrong and what went right? Did most things go wrong, or are there things that we can look to that happened in 2004? Well, you know, that weren't so bad. And then Thursday is my pre-Christmas show entitled Merry Christmas. And we're going to talk about, well, is Merry Christmas an appropriate greeting? Maybe it should be.